Hola, buenos días a todos ustedes y gracias
Good morning to everyone.
día de hoy con
Thank
nosotros.
you for being here with us today. I would like to give you a cordial welcome to this conference,
Una elección de vida
which is on a life and death choice between two systems, the BRICS, the scientific economic revolution, which will change the world. It is the Mexico LaRouche Citizens Movement organizing this. Before we begin, I'd like to tell you the order with which we'll proceed. First, we will hear Mrs. Helga Zepp LaRouche by video conference presentation with a simultaneous translation into Spanish. We also had the expectation that at least three diplomatic people who are going to come here, but for other reasons, which I'm not aware of, are not here yet. But we hope that over the course of Mrs. LaRouche's presentation, they will, or some of them will be here with us today. Once we finish with this first part of the presentation, we will either have our other guests speak, but otherwise we will go immediately to a period of questions and answers. Then there will be a very brief recess, and then we will go on to the second panel of this conference, and that will be based on the presentations of a representative of the Mexican LaRouche movement, a representative of the Spain LaRouche movement, and a representative of the LaRouche movement in the United States. So very well. So now we are going to present Helga Zepp LaRouche, who is the founder and president of the Schiller Institute and an expert in Friedrich Schiller and Nicholas of Cusa. And I forgot to say she is the wife of Mr. Lyndon LaRouche. So we can begin with her video presentation now.
Hello.
Hola.
I'm very happy to send you my greetings.
Me alegra mucho saludarlos por este medio, no solo a ustedes en México, sino también a la gente que nos ve y nos escucha en Argentina, Chile, en Perú, en Guatemala, España, Colombia y probablemente en muchos otros países. La civilización se encuentra ahora en una encrucijada, donde el destino futuro de la humanidad está completamente abierto. Todavía podríamos encontrarnos en una guerra mundial que conduciría a la extinción de la civilización. El peligro es muy grave y está allí. Pero la razón por la que, sin embargo, soy extremadamente optimista de que hay una oportunidad de evitar eso, y no solo evitarlo, sino empezar una nueva era de la civilización, algo completamente diferente, mucho más en coherencia con la dignidad del hombre. Y eso tiene que ver con el desarrollo de los países del BRICS y muchos países que se han unido a esa combinación de naciones. En la actualidad es muy peligroso debido a las provocaciones del presidente Poroshenko de Ucrania, de no solo interrumpir a la población del este de Ucrania toda ayuda humanitaria, las escuelas, pensiones, la financiación de los hospitales, en un claro intento de provocar a Rusia a responder y así envolver a Rusia en una guerra, posiblemente con la OTAN. Poroshenko incluso lo dijo explícitamente que no se puede excluir una guerra con Rusia. Yo pienso que la única respuesta a eso debe ser que la comunidad internacional debe denunciar lo que Poroshenko hace. Quien llegó al poder tras un golpe en Kiev con la ayuda de muchos nazis, y su gobierno está plagado de nazis hasta la actualidad. Y eso fue resultado de la manipulación a largo plazo, especialmente de los británicos, de los Estados Unidos, de la OTAN, de la Unión Europea y, por desgracia, también del gobierno alemán. Así que pienso que la única respuesta puede ser que la comunidad internacional denuncie lo que Poroshenko hace y absolutamente debe detener las sanciones contra Rusia, porque se basan en mentiras y en provocaciones flagrantes. Y por tanto, cualquier país, especialmente en Europa, que quiera sobrevivir, debe poner fin a esta política y mirar a la perspectiva que existe para todo el mundo en forma de los países del BRICS. Ahora, el mundo afortunadamente ha cambiado y la combinación de poder ya no es la que solía ser hace 4 meses. Empezó realmente hace más de un año, cuando el presidente Xi Jinping anunció la nueva ruta de la seda, que era la idea de combinar las antiguas rutas comerciales entre China y Europa a través de Asia Central. Y esto por sí solo ya era una fantástica perspectiva, porque la antigua ruta de la seda no solamente conectaba países y naciones, sino en aquel entonces permitió superar los enormes desafíos del desierto, de los mares, y condujo a un gran paso adelante en la evolución y el desarrollo de la civilización en ese momento. Hoy día significaría mucho más de lo que voy a hablar a medida que avanzo. Luego, el siguiente paso fue que Xi Jinping en noviembre del año pasado agregó a eso la concepción de la ruta de la seda marítima, que de nuevo fue la idea de combinar a todos los países del Pacífico y aumentar el comercio mediante la construcción de puertos, rutas marítimas e integrar a todo el sur de Asia y al sudeste asiático mucho, mucho más. Después, el siguiente gran paso en la evolución del nuevo sistema fue la cumbre que tuvo lugar en mayo entre el presidente Putin y Xi Jinping en Shanghái, donde concluyeron cerca de 48 importantes acuerdos de cooperación económica y el famoso acuerdo de gas por 30 años, que ya era un gran acontecimiento porque significó que a partir de eso, Rusia y China se unieran en una asociación estratégica que persistirá. Luego, el siguiente paso realmente cualitativo ocurrió cuando los países del BRICS se reunieron en julio en Fortaleza, Brasil, donde concluyeron importantes acuerdos y especialmente decidieron crear una nueva institución financiera, el nuevo Banco de Desarrollo, un banco enteramente dedicado al financiamiento de proyectos y ya no la especulación. Y también crearon el acuerdo de la Reserva de Contingencia, el ARC, ambas instituciones con un capital inicial de 100 mil millones, y el ARC se supone que defenderá a todos los países que participen en él contra los ataques especulativos de los fondos buitre, de los fondos especulativos y de las instituciones similares. Ahora, con motivo de esa conferencia de los BRICS, Xi Jinping el 16 de julio resumió el espíritu de este esfuerzo. Dijo, la historia nos enseña que la ley de la selva no es la forma de coexistencia humana. Cada nación debe obedecer el principio de equidad, aprender de los demás, cooperar y buscar el beneficio mutuo y promover la creación de un mundo armonioso, una paz sustentable y prosperidad conjunta. A los países occidentales les cuesta mucho trabajo imaginar que hay un grupo de naciones cuyos líderes están efectivamente trabajando realmente por el bien común. Sin embargo, en la historia de esa idea tiene una tradición filosófica en las obras de Nicolás de Cusa, el gran pensador del siglo XV, el fundador del Estado Nacional Moderno y de la ciencia moderna, quien presentó la idea de que la concordancia en el universo, en el planeta, solo puede ser posible si todo el microcosmo se desarrolla armoniosamente con respecto al macrocosmo. Si se aplica esto a las naciones, solo puede haber paz en el planeta si todas las naciones tienen el máximo desarrollo potencial y donde su interés es desarrollar a las otras naciones de la mejor manera posible y viceversa. Y a propósito, esa idea fue parte de la paz de Westfalia, que puso fin a 150 años de guerra religiosa en 1648. Y eso también sentó las bases del derecho internacional y de la Carta de las Naciones Unidas. Así que esa idea es hoy el principio rector de los países del BRICS. Y en ese espíritu han surgido una gran cantidad de proyectos. Después de la conferencia de los BRICS, hubo también una reunión entre los jefes de Estado de los BRICS, con los jefes de Estado del UNASUR y con los líderes del CELAC. Y ellos acordaron en tal número de proyectos que si se implementaran todos, lo que ya ha comenzado transformará a toda América Latina completamente en unos años. Por ejemplo, existe cooperación nuclear entre muchos países, entre China, Brasil, Argentina, Rusia, India, Bolivia y muchos otros más. Se construye un segundo canal de Panamá en Nicaragua con la ayuda de los chinos. China también ayuda en la construcción de un ferrocarril transcontinental en toda América Latina, partiendo de un tren de Brasil a Perú. Esencialmente, lo que ha sucedido con toda esta geometría es que ha surgido un enorme optimismo y los países que trataron de desarrollarse por décadas y que no se les permitió debido a las condicionalidades del FMI, ahora avanzan con la ayuda de los BRICS, con la ayuda de las nuevas instituciones financieras que se crean. Esa es una fase completamente nueva en la historia de la civilización. Y esto ha dado un gran salto en las últimas 3 semanas, porque hace 3 semanas hubo elecciones de medio periodo en Estados Unidos que llevó a Obama a una derrota aplastante y que en cierto sentido, aunque no ha resuelto el problema de Estados Unidos, porque ahora se tiene a los aún más problemáticos republicanos que tomarán el cargo de las 2 cámaras del Congreso en enero. Pero hay algo que ocurre en Estados Unidos también. Sin embargo, la derrota de Obama, en cierto sentido, simboliza la caída de Estados Unidos y la reducción de Europa, que es como una colonia del gobierno actual de Washington. Eso se demostró en la recientemente concluida reunión de la APEC en Pekín, porque lo que sucedió ahí fue básicamente que Obama y los europeos no participaron, pero en la siguiente reunión del grupo de los 20 en Australia, también los europeos fueron marginados, porque realmente no tienen nada que ofrecer. Los europeos y Estados Unidos tienen un sistema que se basa totalmente en el monetarismo. Y ese sistema que ha sido denunciado, por cierto, por el Papa Francisco, quien ha dicho que a este sistema económico se le debe aplicar el 5º mandamiento, no matarás, porque si mata. De hecho, este sistema que se basa completamente en el lucro y que solo ha enriquecido a unas cuantas personas mientras empobrecen a muchos, es un sistema donde ahora 85 personas en el planeta tienen la misma riqueza que 3.500 millones de personas. Y el Papa Francisco dijo básicamente que un sistema que busca el fin del lucro debe cambiarse. Y ese fue su mensaje a la reunión del grupo de los 20. Bien, en la reunión de la APEC fue muy claro que el moribundo sistema monetarista va en descenso. La intención original del presidente Obama era no permitir el debate sobre el Banco Asiático de Inversiones en Infraestructura o sobre la Ruta de la Seda en la reunión de la PEC, pero en los 7 días previos a la cumbre de los líderes de la PEC, la dinámica cambió completamente. Xi Jinping presentó paso a paso las iniciativas chinas. La nueva Ruta de la Seda es uno de los programas realmente lo que significa que China, que ha experimentado el mayor desarrollo de cualquier país en el planeta en los últimos 30 años, ha sacado a cientos de millones de personas de la pobreza desde las reformas de Deng Xiaoping. Y China ha ido muy lejos en estos 30 años. Al principio cometió algunos errores mediante la producción de mano de obra barata para la exportación a los Estados Unidos y Europa, pero paso a paso ha superado eso. Y también fue el periodo en el que China solo copiaba de otros países. Cualquiera que haya hecho una revolución industrial copió de otros países, incluidos los Estados Unidos. Y diría que todavía lo hace con el espionaje de la ASN, lo cual tiene muy molestos, por ejemplo, a los industriales europeos. Así que la gente no debe armar un gran escándalo sobre eso, pero China ha dejado con éxito ese periodo detrás, porque ahora es una sociedad que se basa en la innovación y la industria, y es líder mundial en muchas áreas. Así que esto lo presentó Xi Jinping. También el nuevo Fondo de Desarrollo de la Ruta de Seda, a que China financiará con 40 mil millones de dólares, y en la reunión del ASEAN también anunció que gastará 20 mil millones para impulsar la Ruta de la Seda Marítima. Así que hay un gran optimismo que dio lugar a la situación donde básicamente todos los países se apiñaron en torno a China y la zona de libre comercio del Asia-Pacífico, el FTAAP, fue el modelo de libre comercio dominante. E incluso cuando Obama hizo su discurso, dijo que el TPP, la Asociación Transpacífico, que originalmente pretendía excluir a China, sería solo un peldaño hacia el modelo chino más incluyente. China, por lo tanto, ha tomado el liderazgo y ha tomado el liderazgo no solo en todas estas iniciativas de infraestructura económica, sino que también ha tomado el liderazgo en el programa espacial. China hizo un gran avance con su misión lunar en diciembre pasado, el aterrizaje del U-2 en la Luna, y ha acelerado aún más la misión con la idea de muy pronto traer materiales de la Luna a la Tierra, como con la extracción del helio 3 y su uso para una economía de fusión en la Tierra. Esa es una perspectiva fantástica, porque una vez que se use el helio 3 para los procesos de fusión en el planeta Tierra, eso le dará a la humanidad la seguridad energética, la seguridad de materias primas, y abandonaremos completamente la perspectiva de pelear por los supuestamente escasos recursos. En los acuerdos recientes entre Rusia y China, de Rusia e India, también acordaron colaborar en el espacio, donde India tuvo su logro sensacional con su primer orbitador de Marte. De ese modo, India se convirtió en la primera nación en tener un objeto orbitando a Marte en su primer intento, y que también fue alrededor del 10% del costo de un proyecto equivalente de la NASA en su momento. Ahora, el único desarrollo positivo proveniente de Europa en el periodo reciente ha sido el logro magnífico de la Rosetta y el módulo de aterrizaje File, que aterrizó en el cometa Shuri, que es un programa que tomó 10 años y Rosetta tuvo que viajar a 7.100 millones de kilómetros para llegar a ese cometa, donde se busca conocer sobre el origen del universo, sobre la evolución de la vida y cuestiones similares. Ahora, ¿por qué son estos avances espaciales tan emocionantes? Ante todo, refutan completamente las mentiras y la locura del movimiento ecologista y de sus amos oligárquicos, como el Fondo Mundial para la Naturaleza, el Club de Roma, el Príncipe Felipe y el Imperio Británico en general, quienes aseguran que vivimos en un sistema cerrado de escasos recursos y, por lo tanto, la humanidad solo puede vivir con desarrollo sostenible. Eso es obviamente una gran mentira, porque obviamente no vivimos en un sistema cerrado, vivimos en un universo antientrópico, en desarrollo, con principios completamente diferentes. El gran científico germano-estadounidense y especialista en cohetes, Kraft Erika, desarrolló la idea de la colonización espacial como la siguiente fase de la evolución de la humanidad. Él tenía la idea que originalmente la evolución del universo, la vida se desarrolló del océano con la ayuda de la fotosíntesis hacia los continentes. Y luego se desarrollaron especies con un metabolismo de una densidad de flujo energético cada vez más superior. Y cuando surgió el ser humano, los seres humanos se desarrollaron rápidamente al asentarse a lo largo de los océanos y los ríos. Luego, con el tiempo, desarrollaron la infraestructura, canales. Carlomagno fue el primero en proponer la construcción de canales entre los ríos, caminos. Luego, con el desarrollo del ferrocarril, la infraestructura conquistó cada vez más el desarrollo interior de los continentes. Y con la nueva perspectiva de la nueva ruta de la seda, que por cierto nosotros propusimos cuando se derrumbó la Unión Soviética, primero con la propuesta del Triángulo Productivo y después de la desintegración de la Unión Soviética en 1991, propusimos la nueva ruta de la seda para conectar los centros industriales y de población europeos con aquellos de Asia, y la llamamos el Puente Terrestre Eurasiático, la nueva ruta de la seda. Ahora, esto está en la agenda, y cuando se construye ese proyecto, será un puente terrestre mundial que traerá prosperidad a todos los rincones del planeta y superará el subdesarrollo de todas las zonas sin litoral que existen en todos los diferentes continentes. Pero luego, esa fase de la evolución concluirá, y luego la fase natural de la evolución es construir y extender la infraestructura hacia el espacio cercano. El otro nombre para eso es la colonización espacial y el desarrollo del espacio. Es cierto, al igual que la antigua ruta de la seda, la nueva ruta de la seda también intercambiará las tecnologías más avanzadas. En la época de la antigua ruta de la seda, era la producción de seda, la fabricación del papel, la pólvora, tecnologías de la porcelana, y hoy en día será el intercambio de la energía nuclear, la tecnología de fusión, la investigación y viaje espacial, y todo el mundo, todo el planeta se transformará para convertirse cada vez más en una economía basada en el conocimiento. Y todo el mundo puede ver que la concepción fantástica de Vladimir Bernatsky es absolutamente probable. Concretamente, que hay una diferencia fundamental entre los seres humanos y los animales. Que la humanidad es la única especie capaz de una y otra vez descubrir cosas que son completamente nuevas, que nadie incluso pudo pensar, que nadie hizo antes. Y ese es un proceso en que estamos, en una encrucijada de realmente despegar. Solo piensen, los últimos 10.000 años de historia humana, desde la última glaciación, 10.000 años, es un periodo muy corto de tiempo si se compara con la edad del universo en general. Pero el desarrollo que tomó lugar en estos 10.000 años es absolutamente enorme. Por ejemplo, un objeto que solía ser un bifaz, hoy en día es del tamaño de un teléfono inteligente y con eso se pueden hacer muchas cosas. Se pueden tener videoconferencias internacionales, se pueden hacer investigación, se pueden hacer muchas cosas. Ahora piensen, el bifaz al teléfono inteligente son objetos del mismo tamaño, pero ¿cuánta tecnología ha requerido? Y ahora piense, si seguimos haciendo este tipo de desarrollo, ¿dónde estará la humanidad en 100 años? ¿En 1000 años? ¿En 10.000 años? Eso hace obvio que la concepción de Bernatsky, que la evolución del universo, de lo inorgánico hacia la esfera biológica, a la noósfera, se desarrolla de tal forma que la noósfera se volverá cada vez más dominante sobre la biosfera. Y la creatividad humana es lo que dominará y será dominante en todo el universo. Por lo que tenemos que definir el presente desde la perspectiva del futuro, porque podemos ver ya de lo que será capaz la humanidad en los próximos cientos y miles de años, y que todavía estamos en la fase embrionaria de la civilización y debemos volvernos adultos ahora. Es claro que este nuevo orden económico que surge rápidamente con la ayuda de China, Rusia, India y de los países del BRICS, absolutamente debe ser combinado con un nuevo renacimiento cultural y con la educación estética del hombre. Se basa en una imagen del hombre en la que cada ser humano, cada niño que nace en este planeta, tiene el potencial de convertirse en un genio, no un genio como una persona que hace, ustedes saben, cosas extrañas, sino un genio que es un alma bella, una persona a la que, según Federico Schiller, la pasión y el deber, la libertad y la necesidad son la misma cosa, porque no habrá más una contradicción en la persona que hace alegremente lo que contribuye al desarrollo futuro de la humanidad con lo que le gusta hacer. No hará su deber como una tarea que no le agrada, sino que encontrará su identidad en la creatividad, que se convertirá en la identidad de toda la humanidad. Es por eso que ponemos tanto énfasis en la cultura clásica, porque debemos, cuando rechacemos al sistema monetario moribundo, debemos rechazar también la cultura popular horrible que acompaña a la globalización, que tiende a convertir a los seres humanos en bestias, o al menos en imbéciles. En lugar de eso, lo que debemos hacer, debemos revivir las mejores tradiciones de la cultura en cada nación. Como por ejemplo China, tiene una maravillosa historia antigua de 5.000 años y tiene 2.500 años de confucianismo. Y esa filosofía actualmente guía las políticas de Xi Jinping. No tengo ninguna duda que ese es el caso. India tiene igualmente una larga tradición y también es una de las cunas de la civilización. Tiene una historia rica filosófica de la tradición védica, el Upanishad, la hermosa obra dramática del periodo Gupta, el maravilloso renacimiento indio que duró desde el final del siglo XIX a principios del siglo XX y produjo grandes poetas como Tagore. Se tiene a Rusia, que cuenta con poetas tan extraordinarios como Pushkin, científicos como Mendeleev y Bernaski. En España tenemos a Cervantes, a Goya. En Italia a Dante, Leonardo, Brunelleschi. En Alemania tenemos las ideas maravillosas y las tradiciones de Nicolás de Cusa, Kepler, Bach, Beethoven, Schiller. Y tenemos que revivir todas estas fases altas en nuestras culturas y después tener un diálogo de la civilización, donde cada uno de nosotros, cada nación, se relaciona con la expresión más alta del otro. Y de esa manera podemos crear un nuevo renacimiento que incluso vaya más allá de que existía hasta ahora. Así tendremos un nuevo paradigma de la civilización y los inicios de eso ya se están dando. Por eso tengo toda la certeza de que también hay esperanza para México, a pesar de los terribles peligros y la degeneración que hemos visto en los últimos 30 años, desde el tiempo de López Portillo, donde las drogas, los secuestros y el crimen se han apoderado de mucha de la vida en México. Sin embargo, debido a que hay aspectos muy positivos en América Central y en América del Sur, pueden ayudar a influir desde fuera a lo que ocurre en México ahora mismo. Por lo que cabe esperar que mediante una combinación de ayuda desde afuera y con un liderazgo sólido dentro de México, puede ocurrir un temprano cambio de dirección de los acontecimientos. Ahora, no se enfoque en los Estados Unidos en este momento. Estados Unidos deben ponerse en orden ellos. Y ya saben, existen fuerzas que buscan cambiar la dirección de Estados Unidos. Lo que deben hacer es enfocarse en América del Sur, en Brasil, en Cuba. Porque cuando Lin, hace 32 años, trabajó con López Portillo en su Operación Juárez, esa idea, que fue muy parecida a lo que sucede ahora, a pesar del hecho que López Portillo empezó a implementarla, no pudo tener éxito, porque en ese momento los gobiernos de Brasil y Argentina no apoyaron a López Portillo. Hoy día tenemos una dinámica diferente, porque ahora los gobiernos de Brasil, bien, son parte del BRICS, y Argentina, y estoy convencida que tal como van las cosas, Argentina muy pronto se unirá a los BRICS. Por lo tanto, se tiene una dinámica completamente diferente en toda América Latina. Vean también lo que hace Cuba. Cuba es un país muy pequeño, no tiene muchos habitantes, pero en este momento ofrece un magnífico liderazgo en la lucha contra el ébola, lo que deja en vergüenza a países más grandes y más ricos, porque han enviado suministros médicos y todo tipo de ayuda médica cuando nadie lo hizo. Y este liderazgo de Cuba debe tomarse como un modelo. Ahora, nosotros trabajamos arduamente. Cuando digo nosotros, quiero decir el movimiento de la RUSH. Trabajamos muy duro para cambiar a los Estados Unidos desde el interior. Y en el Partido Demócrata e incluso en el Partido Republicano, hay gente que reconoce que no hay una buena razón por la que Estados Unidos no coopere con los BRICS. Y dado que Obama perdió, y hay una gran convulsión debido al desplome de la economía estadounidense, la sequía en el suroeste. Pueden ocurrir cambios rápidamente, pero también trabajamos con los países europeos para hacerlos que se unan. En la última conferencia de prensa entre Xi Jinping y Obama en Pekín, Xi Jinping le dijo a Obama, le dijo, invito a Estados Unidos a participar en el BRICS, a unirse a la nueva ruta de la seda, a unirse al Fondo de Desarrollo de la Ruta de Seda, y esto está abierto a cualquier otro país que quiera participar. Y cambiaremos a Europa. Detendremos el enfrentamiento de Europa con Rusia y detendremos las sanciones que arruinan mucho más a Europa que a Rusia, porque para Rusia es como en el fondo es una suerte, obligando a que haya vínculos más estrechos entre Rusia, China, India y todos los otros países del BRIC y Asia. En tanto que la industria alemana, la francesa y la industria italiana se desploman como resultado de esta política totalmente inmoral y errónea. Así que ahora estamos ante una encrucijada. El sistema perverso del Imperio Británico de Wall Street, de Londres, todavía existe. Pero la realidad es que ya están acabados. Se trata solo de si podrán hundir al mundo con ellos en una catástrofe o no podrán. Pero existe una perspectiva optimista que con el nuevo centro de poder, básicamente basado en Rusia, China e India, y en un contexto más amplio, los países del BRICS y los demás países que se asocian a los BRICS, la mayoría de la humanidad ya construye un nuevo orden económico mundial. Así que hay motivos para el optimismo. Por lo tanto, quiero concluir con un verso del poema de Schiller, La Oda a la Alegría, que fue la base de la composición de la Novena Sinfonía de Beethoven. Todos los hombres serán hermanos. Solo hay una humanidad.
Después de esta excelente presentación. This
excellent presentation from Mrs. Helga Zeplarush. Thank you so much, Helga. She is online with us for the question and answer period. The people we were expecting, some diplomats to arrive, are not here. But I would like to present to you Mrs. Gabriela Cedillo Perez. She is the general coordinator of the China Today magazine, and she is going to make a few remarks to us at this point. So we can begin with her presentation. She'll speak to us for a few moments. After this brief presentation of hers, we will then go to the question and answer period with Mrs. LaRoche. So we will begin with a video which they have requested we present before the remarks of and after we show this video, then we will directly ask her to speak. We'll see. Unexpected. Necesitamos sonido, por favor. México, necesitamos sonido. Pedimos disculpas por el problema técnico. Tenemos imagen, pero no tenemos sonido de la Ciudad de México. You're on the air.
Yeah, that's what
I don't want to keep you on the air.
Hold on. Ven acá.
Paramos el video para
saber si
ustedes están. No. Hola, hola. Jonás, no estamos obteniendo nada de audio. Sí, hola, Jonás. Habla Denise. Estoy escuchando. George, are you getting an audio feed? Sí, sí te escucho. George, can you hear them?
Sí,
sí, sí es. George, are you getting a video feed?
Video, vamos a continuar con él en unos instantes, pero queremos saber si ustedes están escuchando el audio del video.
No, estamos viendo el video, pero no se escucha el audio de.
¿De qué lado se encima el audio del video con? Bueno, el audio de ustedes con el audio del video.
Bueno, no estamos recibiendo el audio del video, entonces terminen de proyectarlo ustedes nada más y luego retomamos con la charla de la licenciada.
Voy a cancelar el sonido de su lado por ahorita.
Bien.
Para que podamos transmitir el.
Bien, adelante.
Para que podamos transmitir el video aquí.
¿Cuánto dura el video? ¿Cuánto dura el video?
Le regresé un poco para que.
¿Cuánto dura el video?
Why are we not translating?
Because we're not hearing.
He's got video and audio.
George, hold on.
Pero no hubo nada. Okay.
Les pedimos disculpas, estamos teniendo un problema técnico con México. Están presentando un video en la reunión en México, pero desafortunadamente no tenemos la conexión de audio. Será un video corto y en cuanto se acabe ese video, se retomará la conexión de audio. De nuevo, disculpas por el problema técnico. Les pedimos disculpas, estamos teniendo un problema técnico. México está enviando un video, pero no estamos recibiendo audio para poder retransmitirlo. Dentro de poco retomaremos ese contacto de audio. Les pedimos disculpas. Seguimos teniendo un problema técnico con la conexión con México. Estamos recibiendo video, como pueden ver, pero la señal de audio se ha perdido por el momento. Esperamos que se retome dentro de un momento.
Recibimos de nuestro amigo en la embajada rusa, el señor Skoliar, nos mandó avisar que está enfermo y pide una disculpa por no estar aquí. Y agradecemos a la licenciada Gabriela Cedillo, que a pesar de su salud nos está acompañando.
¿Podrías repetir de nuevo? Disculpa, ¿podrías repetir de nuevo?
We are going to end the video for our international video transmission now. We want to simply make sure that if in the United States we can actually be heard at this point. Helga, can you hear what I'm saying?
Segundo.
We hear you.
España y Estados Unidos nos pueden escuchar.
Sí, se le escucha. Adelante. Hola. Sí, adelante. He's got to be able to hear me, George. Adelante. Pueden.
Probando. España, Estados Unidos pueden escuchar.
Testing 1, 2, 3. George, can you hear?
Uno, dos, tres, probando.
Testing 1, 2, 3. George, can you hear me?
We hear you.
Okay, Jonas, ¿me puedes oír? George, put me in consecutive
uno, dos,
so he can
tres,
hear me.
Probando.
He can't
uno, dos,
hear me.
Tres.
He's not hearing me, George. Uno, dos, tres. Uno, dos, tres. Testing 1, 2, 3. Jonas, ¿me puedes oír? Habla Denise. ¿Me puedes oír? Probando. Uno, dos, tres. Probando, probando, probando.
Gracias.
Probando. Uno, dos, tres. Probando, 1, 2, 3, probando, 1, 2, 3, probando.
Sí, disculpen, aquí estaba deshabilitado el sonido, pero okay. Ya una persona muy okay. Amablemente nos indicó.
Ok,
gracias.
Ahora sí puedes oír.
Te podemos escuchar bien, okay, va
George,
a tomar la palabra.
Now. Ok, so now, let's go into the translation. Gabriela Cedillo is going to speak to us now. And I just wanted to make sure that technically we were in good shape so that you could hear what we're saying, and apparently that is the case. So now we can proceed with her remarks.
Hola, hola.
Hello, hello. Sí, se escucha bien. Adelante.
Uno, dos, tres.
Se escucha bien. Adelante.
Okay, perfecto.
Very good.
Okay, hola, buenos días.
Well, good morning. I want to thank all of you. Thank all of you for being here today with us, and to the LaRouche movement in Mexico. And we're very glad to have been invited by them here. As you have seen, I represent the magazine China Today. I'm the coordinator of that magazine. And this magazine, we're presenting a view, as you're able to see in the video, of what China is today. We've been doing this for about 60 years. And I want to talk briefly. I'm going to be brief because I'm almost voiceless at the moment. But I want to tell you a little bit about, before going into the subject of the BRICS, talk a little bit about what the Chinese dream is. Because through the new Chinese president, Xi Jinping, who has a new outlook at this point for China, much is said about the Chinese dream, which is compared to the American dream, but there are different aspects to this. The American dream has been created with an idea of the whole country for all of the nations of the world, but on the other hand, the Chinese dream is with the idea of having an internal prospect of growth, of patriotism, So now can you hear me okay? This is one of the emblematic cities of China, and the Great Wall, which everybody knows, and one of the palaces of Peking. I want to be very brief because, like I say, my voice is very bad. And for its last couple of years, it's almost impossible to read a newspaper, watch the news, or to not have a reference to China and its impact on other societies currently. The growth of China has been unique in the world, and in the last 30 years has maintained a 9.9% growth rate, has never dropped below 8%. But in the financial crisis, it did drop some, but even to drop down to 8%, this is still nonetheless a very high rate of development compared to the other countries in the world. The philosophical ideas of the opening and the reform, which have occurred over these last 30 years, are that China has been a kind of socialism, but with Chinese peculiarities. You can't really compare it to any other country. It has a market economy, because a lot has been said about this is a socialist, capitalist country, but you can't really define the country in those terms necessarily, in terms of being a market economy, but on the other hand, it still has a socialist feature to it. The development is the overriding concern, and we have tried to develop from going to the world markets and also having the most advanced technologies. And the whole idea is this saying that it doesn't matter what color the cat is so long as it's capable of catching mice. And the government would say this, it doesn't matter what we do, if we have alliances with the United States or with Latin America, so long as these alliances benefit us. In other words, that the cat be able to catch mice. So the idea is to be able to cross a river, jumping over stones to cross the river. In other words, to not make any false move. And that's how China has done this, stepping on stones to cross the river. And they've also tried to have shared prosperity, which if a number of years ago, people many years ago had gone to China, really the only thing that was shared was poverty. Everybody was poor in China, but now there are many very rich Chinese, but what we're trying to do, or they are trying to do, is to share prosperity, not poverty. Over these years, the opening in the economy has been 8% and up for many, many years, but this hasn't been an easy path to move along. It's been a tortured, difficult path because there were many polemics, there's a lot of foreign pressure, because in many countries, people have a very bad view about China, and this is many cases because of lack of knowledge. In China, there are good things and bad things, like any country in the world. We have, notwithstanding the development that China has, there is nonetheless still a lot of poverty and a lot of unemployment, a lot of youth who don't have the opportunity to go to school. So there are a lot of problems, and we have a country of 1.5 billion people, so the Chinese leaders say that if we divide up our achievements among that whole population, they're fewer. However, if we multiply the problems by 1.5 billion, then you've got very serious problems. So they have taken a path which is the correct one, but it hasn't been an easy path. Excuse me for coughing. There are two goals, which is to make Chinese a moderately prosperous country. And this is the idea of by the year 2021. That is the goal of the governing party. China always plans its development on a five-year basis. So they now have a view of where they want to be by the year 2021. And they want to transform China into a modern socialist country, a prosperous country, a powerful country, a democratic country, to advance culturally and advance in harmony. And this will by the year 2049, which is their great anniversary year. So you can see that the Chinese people, leaders, think not only in terms of the next 5 years, but way into the future. As I was saying, there is a lot of discussion of the Chinese dream. The new leadership, which leads China, have a new march that they've launched to make this dream a reality. They want to revitalize China, and as you can see, for example, the Three Gorges Dam has been built, which is a which was a really large development project. Internationally, it was very much praised, and also the development of the train, about which there have been so much discussion here in Mexico, this whole question of the Chinese trains in Mexico, whether or not it will be built. And in fact, China, on terms of infrastructure, has advanced quite a bit. I've been in China four times myself, and the fact is that when you get to China, from one year to the next, the change is dramatic, it's drastic. Whether it be in the most simple provinces, obviously if you go to Shanghai or to Beijing, these are enormous changes. So the technological development and the infrastructural development has been really significant over the last years. Trade of China with Latin America currently has grown significantly. It's grown at more than 30%. From 2011, it was $245 billion, and in 5 years, it should reach about $400 billion. So China has been looking in the direction of these countries, the developing sector countries such as Latin America and also Africa as well. So the Chinese dream for this last year, 2013, with the new president, Xi Jinping, this has been broadened because China's become a powerful country and a prosperous country, as I was saying to you. The idea is to spread the idea of China, patriotism and the spirit of the times and of the Chinese people. And the developing world is one that's developing rapidly as well. We're talking about sharing a new society because China has already been in favor of peace. Although China does have important advances in military terms and is well armed, China is a country that has suffered a lot of wars, a lot of interventions. But nonetheless, China is always seeking to be a peaceful country, a Pacific country, and have peaceful agreements with others. Also, the promotion of culture, which is something that China is doing with all of the countries of the world, especially with the countries of Latin America. With Latin America, because we've had the opportunity to have an increase of scholarships. Those of you who are studying universities, you know that scholarships are often wasted because there's no requests from Mexicans who want to go to China. But I would like to extend to you an invitation for you to know what the possibilities are to study either languages or in any university you might be interested in studying. And there's a lot of possibilities for doing that. So China is broadening its cultural relations with all the countries of Latin America. And based on President Xi Jinping's visit last year and with this whole opening that we have with Mexico, there were previously 30 scholarships last year to 300, and now there's more and more. The problem is they're wasted, i.e. not taken up. So I would ask you to look into this and to see that there are opportunities beyond those of the United States or other countries, that Asia and China are opening up opportunities for growth for us. Also, in terms of the Chinese dream, there is the space career, space profession. This has been going on for 37 years. The first thing that China did in terms of going into outer space, well, it wasn't so great because the first failure was that one of its first astronauts perished. But nonetheless, he is known as the father of the Chinese space race. And today, China has placed in its third mission, a non-manned mission, but one of the greatest successes of the moment. So for 37 years, China has managed to develop a presence in space, as distinct from many other emergency emerging countries, which we don't have any space development. China also offers the possibility of studying, offers Mexicans who are interested in studying space issues. There are scholarships for that as well, for anyone who might be interested in that. Now, if we're talking a bit about the BRICS, we know that the BRICS are five emerging powers, and we know that Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are the BRICS. And this is a very important bloc because 43% of the world population is in these five countries, and 25% of the GDP comes from these five emerging powers, and 23% of the territory is covered by these countries. They're very big countries, Brazil, China, which have a land area which is really very large, so it's also a lot of population as well. The BRICS can be considered a geopolitical phenomenon. This has to do with the change, with the transition which has occurred in the relations among countries. Previously, one might have not even imagined that this could happen, but now these are people who are opposed to the current norms and standards internationally, and therefore the development of the countries of the world. There's the World Bank, there's the International Monetary Fund, which are closed and are only controlled by the powerful countries. But the BRICS are thinking of growing by developing in financial terms as well. The BRICS, at their last meeting, they agreed to promote financial mechanisms, beginning with the new development bank, which would begin with a $50 billion capitalization supplied by five countries, each of the five countries, and then the creation of a contingency fund to be able to resolve the financial problems under conditions where there's difficulties in so doing or under conditions of financial crisis. So it can be said that this fund and this bank are not closed merely to the BRICS, but it's actually open to all countries, all developing sector countries, to the emerging countries, so that they can join and collaborate. So the BRICS are not closed. So this is an opportunity for many countries to need support or need financial resources. So in conclusion, because I think my time has run out, I will just say to you that the BRICS are betting on Latin America. Latin America is an area for a partner, not only in investment, but also closely related to China, especially, and also to Russia. Currently, this has become a point of cooperation with Brazil, Chile, Mexico, Argentina, Venezuela, and together they represent 60% of the exports to China, and exchange with Brazil is about $42 billion, and that was previously the giant, but now, for example, with Peru, there's a free trade agreement with China, and different than the one with Mexico, where the balance of trade is quite off balance. But so I think that we have to understand that we have a market of 1.5 billion people, a market where Mexican businessmen, Mexican students can turn towards China. They're very interested in having Mexican companies have a presence in China. But here in Mexico, we often complain about the lack of proper balance of trade with other countries, but in the case of Mexico, we can export to China, and Mexico and China needs a lot of this. So I would invite you to know more about how to do business with China. So thank you very much, and I would like to invite you again to know our magazine, China Today. We've had special issues on the BRICS in previous two editions of the magazine, and those editions on the BRICS. We had a special on APEC, and we would really like to invite you to get to know this. This is the a new way to get to know China. This is not by way of promo, but it's just information of the good and the bad which happens in China. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you. Thank you to Gabriela, and now we will open the session of questions and answers. This is being transmitted live over the internet over laruchepub.com in Spanish, and those of you who are viewing us in online can send in questions to preguntas@laruchepub.com. Good. So if the way we're going to do the questions is that people should please come up to the table. Let's make a little short line here in front of the table. You'll take the microphone. You can say who you are if you're representing some school or some institution, and you can make your question either to Helga Zepp-LaRouche or to Licenciada Gabriela. We do have some questions that have come in, and I would like to begin with this while people join us here. And this is a question directed to Helga, which was sent in previously over the internet, and it reads as follows. Mrs. Helga, the president and founder of the Schiller Institute, we are very happy to know that the BRICS will launch a new development bank to finance development projects. And we are working for the idea of a sea-level interoceanic canal in Colombia between Humboldt Bay and Columbia Bay in Colombia, 130 kilometers connecting the two oceans for ships 600,000 tons. It's estimated that it'll cost about $13.5 billion. What would be the conditions for this investment under the BRICS new development bank and required to make this investment? Thank you very much. And this question was sent by Mr. Jaime Gomez, the head of the Civic Committee in favor of the canal in Colombia, and he was sent from Florida in the United States.
Hello. First, I want to greet you all. Now, I think that the difference of the New Development Bank as well as the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank is simply that they are entirely devoted to the financing of real investment projects, things which have to do with physical economy. And in the case of such a canal project, obviously what you need is a long-term financing with relatively low interest rates, so that basically you do not end up with a situation like with the World Bank loans, who used to always give credit for projects, but then demanded the repayment of these loans before the project was viable and contributed to the increase of the productivity of the respective country. And that way the countries fell into the debt trap, which, you know, then meant they were basically in a, you know, kind of a slave system, where they never would get out again. So I think that the difference with all these different banks, and we are actually talking about several banks, we're talking about the AIIB, which is already becoming the most important bank for infrastructure financing, actually, you know, in many countries. Then we have the New Development Bank of the BRICS countries. Then you have the emerging Shanghai Cooperation Organization Bank. You have the new Silk Road Development Fund, which Xi Jinping announced in the context of the APEC meeting, which has 40 billion, and the Maritime Silk Road Fund, which was announced at the ASEAN meetings. So what you can really see is that there is a whole architecture of new financial institutions which are absolutely not involved in the casino speculation of the transatlantic financial system. So while I don't know exactly what the terms would be for this canal project, I'm absolutely certain that it would be long-term enough until the project is completed, and that basically, you know, the return of the money would be really only requested when the project has led to a complete transformation of the economy of Colombia.
No tenemos sonido de México. No tenemos sonido de México.
¿Por qué apagaron el...
Bien. Good afternoon. My name is Alicia Sarasua. And I'm studying political science. In the summits that the BRICS have had, they are promoting a more multipolar world, because you can see now that we have a U.S. hegemony. So my question is, are the BRICS seeking with their multipolar outlook? Are they looking for a Cold War-style multipolarity with a Cold War and militarism, or is it a multipolarity which is based more on economics, such as the sort which we are seeing today?
La pregunta sería para la señora Helga.
Helga.
Hablen. No hay sonido de parte de México, ¿dices?
No. No estoy recibiendo la señal de Helga. Un segundo, por favor.
Ah, no, espera, es de allá el problema.
Un segundo, el problema es acá. Un segundo.
Okay. Well, I would like to take it a little bit back historically to show why the present conception of the BRICS countries is absolutely has nothing to do with geopolitical interest. I think this is very important, because geopolitics is a wrong conception, because it is the idea that one country or several countries have to defend their interest against the interest of some other group of countries, and that kind of geopolitical thinking has led to two world wars in the 20th century. Now, I want to take back the origin of how this whole thing developed, because it is now very clear that the idea of having alternative financial institutions was really a reaction of the Asian countries to the Asia crisis of 97 and the Russian GKO crisis in 98. Because if you remember, these crises were the result of massive speculative attacks by such people as George Soros on the currencies of Philippines, of Thailand, even of Japan. And at that time, you know, the countries were completely helpless against these attacks. But then over a couple of years, they got together in the famous Chiang Mai initiative of 2002, which by now has grown into a fund of 240 billion, essentially to defend countries against speculative attacks. And the AIIB and the New Development Bank, they are actually drawing on the experience of that period. So then naturally, when the United States Federal Reserve went into the quantitative easing, that attracted a lot of money into the emerging countries. But then when the United States phased that out, it led to the reverse motion, namely in the capital exit from the emerging countries back into the dollar. And at that time, you could see the BRICS countries were clearly accelerating their efforts to move in the direction of an own financial parallel architecture, to not be subjugated to these speculative attacks. Now, that is one side of the thing. Historically, I think, you know, this present development really started with President Xi Jinping more than 1 year ago announcing the new Silk Road. Now, when that happened, I personally was extremely happy. I was almost jumping to the ceiling, because, you know, I have been occupying myself for a very long time with the Old Silk Road, which I thought was a gigantic way of communicating among nations, of overcoming challenges. If you look at the pictures of the ancient Silk Road, where camels march through the Taklamakan desert, you know, I mean, this was a gigantic effort, but at that time it led to an incredible exchange of culture, of ideas, and it brought mankind forward tremendously. Now, this idea of a new Silk Road, which was announced by President Xi Jinping, has grown in the meantime. You know, he has added in last November the maritime Silk Road, and at the recent APEC summit, he said it's a concept open to all countries on the planet. He invited in particular President Obama that the United States should join. And this is very important because, you know, if the United States would join, I think all the problems in the world would tend to disappear almost overnight, because then the biggest area of tension would eliminate, be eliminated. But it's also open to other countries. Xi Jinping was in Europe, in France, in Germany, and he has offered a similar cooperation to the European countries. Li Keqiang, the Prime Minister of China, was in Africa, and he has offered to unite all African capitals through fast train systems, which is a fantastic idea. So if you really look at the China BRICS relation to Latin America, the offers to Europe, the offers to America, the offers to Africa, well, you can really say that the new Silk Road is de facto a world land bridge, uniting all countries on the planet. And I think that that is the great challenge of our time, because right now, there are only two ways to go. One is a geostrategic confrontation between the Atlantic countries against Russia and China. This is going on right now. It's extremely dangerous. But if we can convince both the United States and European nations, and I'm talking deliberately not about the EU, because the EU is a terrible construction which is already failing and should never have come into existence in its present form. But I'm talking about the European nations, sovereign nations. So if all of these countries, sovereign nations, would join together and agree on all of these projects, then I'm absolutely certain poverty in the world could be overcome in a very short period of time, a couple of years at most. And then mankind could really start to go into a completely new era of its development. And I think that that is either we do that or we will not exist. So I think the new Silk Road conception and what the BRICS countries have initiated is really, you know, it's the bridge out of the present danger. But it's not geopolitical, and I think we should be very much aware. I also don't like necessarily the word multipolarity, because even if that's used in the universities a lot and all the literature, but multipolarity also implies that there are different interests. But I think we have reached a point in human civilization where we have to proceed from a common aim of all of mankind, and we have to proceed from where does mankind want to be in 10 years, in 100 years from now, and then define the present from that future point of view. And then we can overcome all conflicts. So I think we absolutely must overcome geopolitics, because that is the seed of disaster, as we have seen in two world wars in the last century. I think we have to move in the era of the common aims of mankind, and that is what the BRICS countries have really started to lay the foundation for.
So we have another question coming now.
Buenos días.
Good morning. My name is Goy Bustamante. I'm a student of political science at the National University of UNAM, also, like the last speaker. And I would like to thank the excellent presentation of Mrs. Helga. And so my question is for her with regard to you have, in fact, presented the BRICS as an economic alternative to make a change in the global system. But my question is whether the BRICS also have a proposal or an alternative with regard to security and defense of nations, because, as was mentioned, the Chinese case has increased their military spending, and that's happening with other countries as well. So the question is, on that point, do they recognize there's a different agenda with regard to threats to security internationally, or if it's going to be the same agenda that the West has today?
Well, I think this is a very important question, and President Xi Jinping has made in several of his speeches a reference to the need of an inclusive security arrangement. I recently have reiterated that proposal by proposing that we must have an immediate conference, international conference, to lay out an inclusive security architecture for all of mankind, which should take care of the real security interests of every single nation on the planet. Because if you don't do that, I mean, if you look at the present crisis, for example, between NATO and Russia, which is very, very dangerous and could lead to World War III, how did that come about? It is clear that when the Soviet Union disintegrated in 91, there were many promises given to, you know, Gorbachev, to Kohl, to Genscher, that NATO would never expand its troops to the former GDR territory, that is East Germany, and by implication it would never bring the troops to the border of Russia. And that promise, which has been in the context of the recent 25-year anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, that promise or these promises have been referred to in the recent days quite a lot, but they were broken. At that time, you know, if you remember, the Soviet Union, I mean, despite some problems, you know, shootouts at the White House, the Russian White House, it really disintegrated completely peacefully. I mean, you could have imagined that when the GDR collapsed and you had in Germany the process towards unification, it could have happened that the Russians would have used their military force in order to discourage that process, but they did not, you know. And I totally agree with Russians today when they say, you know, what Merkel is doing is really, in a certain sense, terrible, and I would even say disgusting, because I think the German people owe some thankfulness to Russia that the German unification could take place so completely peacefully as it did. And when the Soviet Union disintegrated, it happened relatively peacefully as well. Now, at that time, there was no reason why Russia should not have been integrated in any kind of security agreements. And, you know, the West likes to say that NATO would have offered membership to Russia, but that is really not true, as, for example, at a recent security conference in Munich was even admitted by Horst Telschick, who is the former director of that security conference, that all the offers which, for example, the Russians made were ignored, and the West never really made an offer to Russia to join. Instead, what they did is, you know, to immediately think in terms of regime change. They started color revolutions against Ukraine in 2004, the Orange Revolution, the Rose Revolution in Georgia. They tried similar color revolutions in Egypt, in Thailand. They are now trying one in Mexico itself against President Nieto. They are trying one against the Czech Republic right now, against Hungary. And they are doing that against any country which is not in agreement with the principles of globalization or is friendly to Putin or to China right now. Now, this color revolution thing is a very disgusting thing. And there was, for a couple of months ago, I think in May, in Moscow, a conference of the military where they defined that color revolutions are a form of war, even if it's not declared. And just now there was a meeting between the Russian defense minister Shoigu and his Chinese counterpart General Chong, where they both agreed that, you know, the color revolution is right now threatening every country in the world which is not going along with the transatlantic policies, and that Russia and China will work together to defeat that. Now, let me say something about this question of color revolution. I mean, color revolution, for example, the American NED, National Endowment of Democracy, they admitted that they spent alone in the case of Ukraine $5 billion to recruit activists. These are people who in large part have no philosophical or ideological conviction, but they are paid agents. And then they get enormous amounts of equipment, buttons, rock bands, other gear, you know, dresses, whatnot. And then they start to activate demonstrations like it happened in the Maidan with the only aim for regime change. And, you know, that is really financed by what? By Wall Street, by the City of London. And we know that these banks, you know, they have not the cleanest white wests. They are involved in drug laundering, in LIBOR manipulation. I mean, I could go into a long list of crimes what these banks are doing. And they're financing with a lot of that money these color revolutions against countries who do not agree to be submissive to the empire. Now, well, let me counterpose this with another element. There were recently midterm elections in the United States where the Republicans won both houses, and there were many articles in the Washington Post in particular where they said, well, really, these were not any longer Democratic elections because they were decided by so-called super PACs, which don't have to report to the FEC, to the election authority, but they can just throw tons of money to buy the elections. And therefore, the United States has really become a plutocracy and is no longer really a democracy. Now, I equate the money from Wall Street buying politicians for the Congress and the Senate and the color revolution because it's based on the same principle. You know, you ignore democracy, you ignore human rights, and you just use tons of money, lots of which comes from illegal sources, to buy both politicians in the United States and in the countries you want to destabilize. Now, these are real problems, and they have to be gotten rid of. The first thing is people have to become aware that that's going on. And therefore, if we continue that, I think we are heading towards a global war. And that's why I think what we need to discuss among serious military people in every country, among security forces in every country, how we can move away from a geostrategic confrontation where one country is trying to destabilize the other one, either by military means, by coups, by subversion, or by buying activists through color revolutions, or even corrupting politicians which are already in the parliament. That has to stop, and we have to put on the agenda instead an international security arrangement which takes care of every country's security interest. For example, in the Middle East right now, you know, if you don't take care of the security interests of Iran, I don't think you can have peace, because Iran is surrounded by, I think, 5 nuclear powers, and therefore these present P5+1 negotiations are extremely important. I mean, they will be concluded, at least the final round is supposed to be on the 24th of this month. So you have to really think through an architecture which takes care of every country. And it is my view since a long time that the only way how you can have security taken care of is you have to have an economic system which is higher than the national or supposed geopolitical interest of groups of countries. And that is why the new Silk Road, understood as a world land bridge, is really the economic underpinning for this inclusive security architecture I'm talking about. Because if you have a development perspective which gives the chance for each participating country to prosper. Xi Jinping always talks about a win-win situation. You know, I'm talking about the Peace of Westphalia conception based on international law. I think then we have a chance to gain peace. But we need to have what Prime Minister Modi from India said, we need a mass movement for development, because only if the population is aroused to fight for their own future and, you know, say we no longer will be victimized by these oligarchical forces, only then can we win this fight. But I think it's in the air, it's eminently possible. I think we are very close to realizing this. And, you know, therefore, I think I'm very happy that I can tell you about these things, because I think you are part of the people who have to stir the country of Mexico and the other Latin American countries in that direction.
Thank you very much. We're going to take another question here from Mexico City. But first, I would like to recognize that there are meetings going on at the University of Libertadores, the Jaime Betancourt Auditorium in Bogota, Colombia, and also the Universidad of Valle in Buga, Colombia as well. Also, there's another meeting gathered at the Red Casa Roja in Guatemala. And of course, there are other locations in different countries of Ibero-America where this webcast is being viewed. So let's take another question here from the auditorium, and then a question which also came over internet from one of the meetings in Guatemala. Hello, my name is Hector Castañón Vizcaya. I'm a transportation worker in the state of Mexico. I'm a Teamster driver. What we're concerned about is the situation of urban mobility. Now it's not mobility, it's immobility. In a situation, there are commitments from the authorities to reform transportation in Mexico. The VRTs, this I believe comes from Curitiba in Brazil. Here, what has been implemented bit by bit is, but the question is whether the BRICS have on their agenda the idea of, or have they analyzed the idea of this project of have this be inclusive for all countries. So for Mexico and other countries, if there's a project that would be viable for us in terms of transportation, Chinese president offers to connect the African capitals by high-speed rail in Mexico. We all know the history of this proposal, but are we included in this idea of very rapid trains and solving transportation generally in the BRICS proposal?
I think if it's not yet formulated, it will be formulated very shortly. I mean, I personally find it very regrettable that the Chinese bid for the fast train between Mexico City and Querétaro, because of political pressure, was stopped for the time being, maybe not forever, but for the time being. And that is the kind of fast-speed rail link which really, you know, I mean, the future of this infrastructure development is an image where the infrastructure of all countries who want it will be as dense as, for example, the infrastructure of Germany. Now, if you ever have looked at the German infrastructure, you have a very well-developed system of integrated river systems, canal systems. These are connected through inland ports to the railway, fast railway, and then only the last part of the transport occurs by truck on the highway. And that is how it should be, because, you know, as you move towards a higher degree of industrialization, time and cost are extremely important. And if you look, for example, in Germany at the industrial area of North Rhine-Westphalia, there you have an almost perfect infrastructure. And that is sort of the model for the whole world. Now, the Schiller Institute, we have just concluded almost a year-long study called The New Silk Road Becomes the World Land Bridge. Now, this report is totally exciting. It's 370 pages, and it not only contains detailed proposals for an integrated infrastructure network all over the world, based on maglev, on fast train systems, but also, you know, building canals and combining that with highways in so-called development corridors, because that was our initial conception of the new Silk Road, which we proposed in 91 when the Soviet Union collapsed. We said we have to combine the industrial and population centers of Europe with those of Asia through so-called infrastructure development bank, where the railway and the highway and the riverways would not just be arteries from A to B, but you would develop corridors, because in these corridors, because of the excellent infrastructure, you can also have new industries, new cities, industrialization of agriculture. So you have the infrastructure as the first step for a real development. And that is our idea, that with the World Land Bridge, we can develop all the landlocked areas of the world in the same way like it is only happening at the seaports or river systems so far. Now, you know, in a certain sense, you know, the infrastructure development of the planet is the necessary next step, and it will happen. I think if mankind is not causing its own extinction through the stupidity of a thermonuclear war, a danger which is not yet eliminated, if we can avoid that, then the development of every country is the most natural next step. And I think what the Chinese dream represents, look, I was in China the first time in 1971, which gives me a certain advantage, because I could travel in several Chinese cities during the Cultural Revolution. And therefore, you know, when I went back 25 years later in 96 to participate in a great conference on the New Silk Road in Beijing, I could, with my own judgment, see what a gigantic development China has made from 71 to 96. But when I returned recently a couple of times, that development has been outpaced again gigantically. And I can tell you, the population in China, which was terribly unhappy in 71 because of the Red Guards painting red color over everything, you know, they sent a few skilled labor for re-education to the countryside, and people were generally really distraught. But now, I have not seen such a happy population, optimistic, and the attitude they have in respect to the new Silk Road is simply to say, look, we were able to uplift several hundred million people from absolute poverty to have a very good living standard. They have beautiful food, they have better housing, they have many, many cars, maybe too many by now. Not enough infrastructure, maglev, but the Chinese trains are fantastic. I traveled with a train from Beijing to Shanghai. This was a train which was entirely made by Chinese engineers, and I have never traveled on such a fantastic train. It goes like quiet, you know, it doesn't bounce you around. You can't hear anything, despite the fact that it goes with 310 kilometers, you know, and the Chinese have by now developed as their trademark the best train building in the world, maybe together with the Spanish, who are also expert in fast train systems. But, you know, that is the future. And, you know, the Chinese idea of the new Silk Road is simply, okay, we transformed most of China from poverty to a very, very good living standard and development, and it is just a question of time when we have overcome the rest of poverty in China, like in the inner region, which is mainly desert. I mean, I was recently in Dunhuang and also in Lanzhou, and we traveled along the old Silk Road. And this is mostly desert. You know, so we have been saying all the time China must develop its interior regions, but only when I traveled there, I really got the full impact of that. That is easier said than done, because if you have to conquer the desert with unclear water resources, because you can't use only the water from the high mountains, because that's a finite water source. But China is committed to do that. And for example, they're building now this railroad very quickly from Xi'an through Lanzhou to Dunhuang and then all the way to Urumqi. And that will then connect to Central Asia and go all the way to Europe. And that approach is simply the idea of the Silk Road, to take the tremendous economic miracle which China has done in 3 decades, what most countries needed 3 centuries for. Just imagine, China did in 3 decades what Germany and Russia and the United States needed 200 years for, or 150 years. So their idea about the new Silk Road is to simply bring that kind of development to every country which wants to participate. And for that matter, you know, the United States, which is now suffering a big drought in the Southwest, which you know also something about in Mexico, they could need a couple of new cities. I mean, I think the United States suffers from a lack of cities, because this suburban sprawl, you can't call a city. You know, it doesn't have an urban culture. It just has highways for eternity, like in Los Angeles. You know, that's not a city. So I think what we need is, like Modi, Prime Minister Modi has announced 100 new cities to be built in India. He wants to create 1 million jobs every month for especially the young people. And then you look what Egypt is doing, which is completely inspired by the development of the BRICS. And with President al-Sisi, they are now widening the Suez Canal. And, you know, they're also having a program to find productive jobs for all the youth of Egypt. And that is the spirit which is spreading, because since the BRICS countries formed this alliance, a lot of fear, which prevented many countries from taking the projects they were wanting to implement for many years, but they were not allowed by the IMF conditionalities. Now, because they have the backing of the BRICS countries, they are more optimistic and more fearless, and they are implementing all of these projects. And I think there is a true renaissance going on, because countries say, we take our own fate in our hands, and we think about our own people and think about the future. So the answer to your question is, while I don't know if the BRICS countries have already detailed plans for this infrastructure in Mexico, it is definitely part of our World Land Bridge report, which you should get your hands on, because the official release is the 1st of December, because we have the idea of having maglev trains and other fast train systems from down the southern tip of Chile all the way up through South America, Central America, all the way up to Canada, and then have these trains go through tunnels in the Bering Strait, basically into Siberia, and from there connect to the Eurasian land bridge. Now, I was at a conference in Moscow a couple of years ago, where some of the engineers and people from the Academy of Science who are thinking about the development of Siberia, they were all over 80, but they were jumping in the air, and they said, look, in a couple of years, we will be able to travel from Acapulco with a maglev train through the Bering Strait tunnel all the way to New Delhi, to Mumbai, more quickly than we can do it by ship today. And that will happen in 20 years. So I think you have to just get a good vision of where we are about to go. And then I think that vision will inspire your compatriots to really mobilize for this.
Thank
I have a question with regard to time. Can we still take another couple of questions here in the auditorium, Helga?
Bueno.
So while we're waiting for an answer from Helga with regard to time, I do want to mention a question which came from one of the meetings in Guatemala. Their question for Helga is, what the impact that BRICS development would have in Central America, given their closeness to the United States? That is to say, whether the transatlantic system with its Wall Street base, or if that continues in the course of disintegration, would this drag the whole region down? How could the BRICS help with this? And I'm going to take a couple of questions here in the auditorium. They haven't told me how much time we have left, but we will take a couple of questions together so that Helga can then close her remarks in response to all of the questions at the same time. The number of other questions have come through email, and we will make sure that Helga receives these questions so that she can also answer them electronically when she can. So, in addition to the question from Guatemala, I would like to accept two more questions from here, from the auditorium, and from the youth in the back, and from you here, and I'll include you also. So there's going to be three questions, one after the other. Say your name, and then let's give Helga the opportunity. Please make the questions brief, and then allow her to answer all together, and that would bring this session to a conclusion. And then we're going to have a 3 to 5 minute break for coffee. But now the remaining questions, one after the other. Thank you. Good. Hello. My name is Perla Benitez, and I'm a translator. My questions are, number one, if there's some sort of presidency of the BRICS, as occurs in the European Union. Number two is, if in the program and structure of the BRICS, are they considering strategies, equity among the different genders? And there has been some advances of this that have been important, and it would be important to spread this to all of humanity. And the third is, what do the BRICS strategy for having sustainable development and reducing contamination, pollution on air and land? Now we have the second of three questions coming from Mexico. Hi. Good afternoon. Good morning. What's the essence of economy? There have been various imperialist capitalist systems. A lot of empires build on the ashes of others, and I wonder about the BRICS, because there hasn't been an economic proposal that has been substantially different. Just rather want to substitute the previous system, different from the United States system. But as I was saying, I don't deny that ecology is not good business for people, environmentalism, but is the planet not a closed system? Well, no, it's not a closed system, but it's a little difficult to send all this garbage up into outer space, just to put it that way. So how would you control pollution on the planet, and would the institutions that exist today continue? Would there be institutions? What would they be? How would they be different? What ideas would they have? And in the final analysis, if there would be an economic change, would this lead to political changes and ideological changes? So what would be the essence of this total change under the BRICS? Thank you very much. And now for the third and last question from here from Mexico. My name is Victor Montoya. I'm a student, medical student from the Polytechnic Institute, and I'm concerned about something. We all face this. In Mexico, like in many countries, we have indigenous peoples, and the economic system, even with the BRICS, even with other ideas, don't resolve the situation of the Indians, the indigenous people. I'm concerned about this because these are going to be my patients soon. I'm going to watch them die. I've seen them die from diseases which are perfectly preventable and treatable. So how do we resolve this problem of these people? How do we integrate them into the economy? How do we make sure that they also don't lose their identity and they don't lose their own spirituality under the tendency towards globalization? How do we achieve that? Thank you very much. So now we would like Helga to turn all of these questions into a single question and provide an answer to all of the questions that have just been presented.
Well, I think the transatlantic system is about to blow. I mean, that is a fact. And I think the only way how Central America can prevent of being torn into that is, you know, we have to have the change in the United States. I'm totally convinced that the question of world war, of plunging into a new dark age on the one side, or, you know, really going into a complete new era of civilization, is really dependent on do we get the United States to join the BRICS? Because if we don't get the United States to join the BRICS, I cannot see how a catastrophe can be avoided. And I can tell you that we are right now mobilized in the United States to try really to go to all the different institutions, constituencies, to understand why this is the case. Now, having said that, and I think I would not tell you the truth if I wouldn't put this up front, because we have a saying in Germany which says the best person cannot live in peace if the evil neighbor does not allow it. So the question is, how do you turn the neighbor to be a good neighbor in order to change this? In the meantime, I think these institutions of the BRICS countries, the four banks I named, they should really be sort of, including the CRA, the Contingency Reserve Agency, I think it's called. This is the idea of having a pool to defend countries against fluctuations in the currency system. That obviously should be broadened, and the more countries participate in these institutions, the better it is. And, you know, I think that it is very important that the Chinese government has said all the time that they are not against the United States. They want to cooperate with the United States. And there must be a drumbeat over the whole world where people have a political discourse in every country, in the universities, in the parliaments, where this alternative, which is represented by the BRICS, becomes discussed. You know, because right now, in the context of the APEC conference, for example, you could see that there was almost zero coverage about the BRICS countries, despite the fact that between the APEC meeting and the G20 meeting in Australia, there was a summit of the BRICS heads of state, and they had many important initiatives, and they were completely blocked out by by the media. So I think a public debate about all of these things, the Silk Road, the Maritime Silk Road, I think that is extremely important, because I think citizens have the right to be informed about, you know, that such options exist. Now, concerning the presidency of the BRICS, I think the present one is just running out, with Brazil, with Dilma Rousseff being the chairwoman. It will then go to Russia, and President Putin at the G20 meeting invited the other BRICS leader to come to the next summit of the BRICS in July in Russia, but they have also basically agreed that there will be much closer cooperation in the meantime, so that is moving forward. I think the question of gender equity. I think that there are many organizations in China in particular who are explicitly trying to improve the situation of women, to have more women having access to universities. One of these organizations is the Song Qingling Foundation, which I saw was also mentioned in the first video which you saw. And I think that there are also similar efforts in all other countries. So I'm not concerned about that. I think China is doing a lot to undo the early mistakes when the globalization basically gave China the role of a cheap labor export nation, producing cheaply for the export markets in the United States and in Europe. And in that period, tremendous difficulties and mistakes were made, which the Chinese government is now moving very rapidly to correct. But the way to go is really to apply the physical science of Lyndon LaRouche, who is the only economist on the planet who deserves that name, because he was able to predict all of these developments and the collapse of the present system since 71. And he has developed a physical science economy, which is centered very much on the notion of energy flux density as the parameter for both economic growth, increase of productivity, population growth, and therefore, you know, the key aim must be to get as quickly as possible to higher energy flux densities in the production process. And what that means concretely is to develop thermonuclear fusion, because that will solve many problems of mankind at once. Because first of all, it will be an extremely clean source of energy. The Chinese are now speeding up their lunar missions of Chang'e 3, Chang'e 4, Chang'e 5, with the idea to develop as quickly the capability of mining of helium 3 on the moon, with the idea to use it as fuel for a future fusion economy on Earth. Now that will be a complete revolution, because contrary to heavy deuterium and tritium, which will be the first generation of fusion technology, but in that first generation you still need turbines and steam to produce electricity, which is, you know, very inefficient. But with helium-3, you will be able to immediately, out of the physical process of the fusion, extract energy and electricity, and that will make the efficiency, I think, you know, almost 70%, which is gigantic. Now, once you have fusion through the fusion torch technology, you can transform all elements, all garbage, everything, not just nuclear residues, but also just ordinary garbage, and you separate the isotopes and you make new raw materials as you want it. As a matter of fact, we are in the process of continuously redefining what are the raw materials which don't exist in a natural condition in the universe, but through human creativity we can you know, recompose that. So once we have fusion, we have limitless energy, because, you know, the available helium-3 on the moon will be at least sufficient for several 10,000s of years. But we will also have raw material security because of this this ability to redefine what is a raw material. So I think that the way to go is not to think about the planet as a scarce resource entity and then quibble over these resources, but the question is to do what is uniquely mankind's identity, that we can always come up with the next higher level of the solution to solve problems which were not solvable on the previously lower level of science and technology. And that is why we are so absolutely focused on space travel. Because, you know, once man masters the technologies associated with moon colonization, with you know, controlling processes on the Mars, or now like the Rosetta to get a handle on comets, on meteorites, on asteroids, we will also be able to defend the planet Earth against such objects, which we are presently not. So the only way how you can guarantee the long-term existence of mankind on the planet Earth is to go outside and to redefine all the problems from the technology of space. And that is what was done with the Apollo project. The Apollo project was a gigantic booster in productivity. And you know, it brought, I think, 14 cent profit in return for every cent invested. And everything from computer chips to Teflon pens to, you know, all kinds of things were the cider effect. And already now you can see that with space medicine, you can essentially, you could solve medical supply for people who are living in the boondocks anywhere, because through space medicine you can supply practically everything to everybody in need. Now, the essence of the economy, of this new economy, well, I think the essence will be creativity. I think we have reached a point in human development where if we don't go away from monetarism, we will not make it. Monetarism is an evil side product of the oligarchical system whereby a few people make a lot of profit at the expense of a lot of people. This has led to a situation where presently 85 people have as much wealth as 3.5 billion people. Now that is not decent. I think that nobody can eat so many caviar in their lifetime to spend, you know, all these billions they have amassed. And, you know, I think that this is a system of the past. It's associated with an oligarchical image of man, namely that only the privileged upper class should live a decent life and billions of people are left to die or going hungry. And that has to be replaced with a completely new identity of mankind, and that is that mankind is the only creative species. I mean, look, if we do what we do now and we move, you know, with the BRICS World Land Bridge Report, we can already see on the horizon that every child on the planet will have access to a universal education, that every child will be able to learn and master his own high language, you know, poetry on the highest level, geography, universal history, natural science, great classical art. And that way you give the precondition that every child can really become a genius. Because genius is not something which is mysterious, but you know, once you learn the method of learning, once you know how the great qualitative discoveries were made, well, it becomes a habit, because then you start to train your mind in such a way that you come up with new flanks, with new hypotheses, with new scientific discoveries. And there, in the realm of genius, there is no limitation. I think that, you know, we are, I really know that if I look at the universal history in a larger, you know, arrow, we have only really stopped to be embryos. You know, we're still babies, if that at all. And we have to reach the age of adulthood where people don't waste their time anymore with speculating with useless stocks in the internet, only to find out one day that everything was a complete gem, the stocks have vanished, it was all just virtual. But people will really develop the joy to be human, to, you know, write poetry, to compose great music, to make scientific discoveries. And everybody who has ever talked to a scientist who is a real, true, passionate scientist, you know, they will tell you that, you know, they don't regard their work as work because they enjoy so much what they are doing, because that is what makes them human. And the same goes for good musicians, for, you know, people who really love classical music. They enjoy it so much that in a certain sense, if they still get a wage for it, they say, oh, that's an additional donation, but my real return is already that I'm allowed to do this. And, you know, I have a vision of the future of civilization, you know, where, you know, people will relate to each other in a completely different way than it's now in this tortured world. You know, if you look at the letter exchange between Gauss and Einstein, or Schiller and Humboldt, or such similar people, they have a completely different way of communicating with each other about ideas, about important conceptions. And, you know, I can see that mankind is just making the first baby steps to reach this new era. So the essence of the new system will be creativity, you know, and money is going to be extremely unimportant. It will be just used as a means to, it will be credit. It will not be so much money. And people who have a different identity, they will also not try to hoard money, but they will try to use the time of their life in the best possible way to be as creative as possible and to be as aesthetically educated as possible, because that is also something which is extremely important, because the aesthetical education is what makes us human. So the last question, I think the question of the indigenous people will also change. I mean, I know that right now, most indigenous peoples in the United States, in Australia, in Africa, well, they are not so happy because they are so poor, you know. And you know, the reason what we are talking about is really not globalization; it's the opposite of globalization, because I think that if you start to proceed from the common aims of mankind first, that which makes all of us human, for example. Nicolaus of Cusa, the great scientist of the 15th century, he said the only reason why people from different cultures and different nations can communicate at all is because each has scientists, has musicians, and they can talk about the universal discoveries they made, which are understood irrespective of their national identity. And I think that if we go into the new paradigm of mankind, we should start first with that which makes us human as a mankind, and then, you know, preserve your own culture. I'm sure that people will preserve their own history and their own culture, but not from the standpoint of exclusiveness, but from the standpoint of inclusiveness of mankind first, and then say, okay, these are my traditions, and I look back at them, but now I'm developing in a harmonious way with all other nations to a higher state of civilization, which is humanity as a whole. And I think that that way, only if we have this development, can we solve this problem. So the new name for peace is development, and that is what we have to implement on Earth now.
Thank you very much, Helga. Thank you for taking time to answer all of our questions. And we would also like to thank Gabriela Cedillo for having been with us here today, although she's actually quite ill. And now we will take a 3-minute break so you can have a little cup of coffee. And then we'll come back for the second panel of our discussion, which will begin. Gerardo Castilleja here in Mexico will begin. And then there will be questions from the auditorium as well. The coffee's on this side, and the room is so full that they had to take the coffee table and put it outside in the vestibule. So please proceed out there, and we will be back in 3 minutes. In fact, this is first call.